And they are the first sign of spring for me. Because growing up on Long Island, they would all depart en masse. And I would get mildly depressed in the course of the winter. And then I would hear sometime in like March, okay. And I'd be like, they're back. They're back. Thank God they're back. Spring is here.
Before we know it, spring will be with us again. For Bird Note, I'm Joni Franklin.
Do you get that excited when you hear the birds come back in the spring?
I don't. I think more dangerous is that it's the crows with their nests. Yes. Because actually, I'm right beside Loheed Mall, and yeah. I think there are that line of trees that they.
Right.
I'm right beside a primary school. I think there's.
You're like by one of those trees that all the birds come in the great freeway. They're heading for, every evening. They're heading, and they end up near your place. And
no, then, not particularly. It's just that if it's only just one couple of crows, because it does take two to make a nest, that they can cause havoc. Like they can chase you. Like I used to bounce a ball with a tennis racket down the street, and if it goes high up, they think you're trying to attack them, and it's kind of bad for that primary school that I'm.
Yeah, they come swooping down on you.
So I think we should do a trade embargo on Bird Note.
If no American bird stories?
Yeah, that's right. If we get only our Canadian bird or Vancouver area, because I think then it makes it, I don't even know where this Long Island bird is. I don't know where it is. I mean, so we can be relating to what's being said. So only the Canadian bird, or the British Columbia, because it's also, I'm talking about interacting, like an Ontario bird, maybe Doug Ford, like that, but anyway.
All right.
How important is this station to you? Local radio, by and for your community, news and information that matters to you. You won't find anything like it anywhere else. Now we need you. We need your voice to support the Community Radio Initiative. You see, radio has been there for you in those important moments, and now we need your voice. You can join the fight for the future of community radio at mycri.ca, because local voices are what shapes our community.
On January 14th, 2025, Burnaby City Council passed a motion that directed city staff to plan for and mitigate the risk of extreme weather events such as flooding and wildfire in the Burnaby Official Community Plan that is currently being developed. While this is a decision that was made with the recent Los Angeles wildfires in mind, according to City Council, the planning for this decision had been months in the making. To learn more about what the planning and mitigation of extreme weather events in Burnaby would look like, CJSF sat down for an interview with one of the leaders of this motion, Burnaby City Councilor Allison Gu. During the interview, we asked Councilor Gu to expand on the planning and mitigation methods that the city hopes to implement, as well as the areas in Burnaby that are at highest risk if an extreme weather event were to occur. Please take a listen.
So the official community plan is every municipality's blueprint for the next 20, 25 years. So Burnaby 2050 is the name of our next official community plan. It designates the land uses and the densities of those uses for every parcel of land in the city. So it's a really powerful planning tool that municipalities have. The provincial government just changed legislation that essentially says that the official community plan has more power than previously it used to. And so it's a really important way to be able to set priorities for the future. And this motion was directing staff to make sure that we're mapping out where regional hazards are happening or are likely to happen because of climate change, such as wildfire and flooding, and look at how we can make sure that we're layering on appropriate land uses and appropriate densities where those hazards are going to occur.
And to expand on that a bit, I noticed that one of the locations that was specifically cited in the motion was Burnaby Mountain and mm-hmm. the university and SFU community. What about Burnaby Mountain and SFU kind of make it a unique area that needs to be specifically addressed when considering climate emergencies?
Mm-hmm. So Burnaby Mountain, of course, is a very large forested area. It's designated as park. It is what we call the urban wildland interface, or the wildland urban interface, also known as the WUI. And when you have such close uses together, so you've got residential, you've got a dense amount of people, and you've got a dense amount of forest, as the threat of wildfire increases because of climate change, because of drier summers, because of a lack of proper forest management for decades, that means that you're exposing a lot more people to the risk of forest fire. And because the way that we build housing, the way that we have materials that are produced, mass consumption, there's just a lot more flammable materials now than what we manufactured, 40, 50 years ago. So the average living room will combust much quicker, like several minutes quicker than the average living room would have in the 1950s and 60s. And that's because the furniture that we create, it's a lot of, paper, cardboard, wood put together with a bunch of plastic and glue. And that kind of stuff just ignites quicker. And so when you have these intersecting risks, they amplify each other. In respect to Burnaby Mountain, the risk further is amplified because of the TMX tank farm, of course, the Trans Mountain tank farm, and the amount, the quantity, the volume of extremely flammable liquid of oil petroleum product is further amplified by the risk of wildfire potentially spreading and igniting one of these tanks, and inversely, the risk of a human error or mechanical error creating a fire that starts at the tank farm and then spreads towards Burnaby Mountain.
You mentioned the pipeline mm-hmm. There. I think maybe I could see one critique people having with a plan such as this, despite the fact that, making sure there is preparation in place for climate emergencies is extremely important. There are still, factors in regards to why this planning is the reason the planning is being put forward is because of the increased prevalence of these climate emergencies due to, ever persisting climate change. Is there plans in the OCP to also, address more overarching systemic issues that sort of contribute to these increased climate emergencies?
Yeah. So unfortunately, with those types of, structures, they, one, are at a different level of government. So the city of Burnaby was in staunch opposition to the pipeline and the expansion of the project all the way through. But the federal government has jurisdiction over that and can override our powers. So we're limited in that sense. And then there's also limitations in terms of certain types of uses that are established grandfathered in uses. So we know that there's existing institutional refinery right alongside the shores. We know that there's the Trans Mountain Expansion Pipeline. The OCP changing that wouldn't change those uses immediately. So even if I was to say, this is a parcel of land that's a house right now, and I want it to be park or school in the future, when I designate that through the OCP, it essentially signals to the future what that will become, but it doesn't mean that the city of Burnaby is going to come and expropriate that land immediately. It doesn't mean any of that. And it doesn't necessarily at all change the market value of that house, especially if that land is going to be converted to a government ownership. They'll pay market price. So the OCP really, what it is important in changing is whether a property gets upzoned. And that upzoning is really kind of looking at how many more times people can live in this parcel of land. And what I'm saying is that, you know, that it's a very complicated process to be buying up properties that we know are at risk. They refer to that as managed retreat. This motion doesn't even call to that because we know we have a lot of questions to answer before we can realistically start to embark on those types of endeavors, such as funding. So what it's saying really is we shouldn't exacerbate the problem by putting a ton of people in an area that we know we're going to expose them to wildfire, flooding, other types of climate change induced hazards, and to take precautions in our kind of conflicting goals, because we have conflicting goals. We have a housing crisis. So we know we need to build more housing. We know we need to build dense housing. We know we need to build them in areas that are close to SkyTrain and transit. So how do we manage all of these conflicting tensions? Right now, thus far, we haven't necessarily put a language or addressed that tension and to kind of consider and balance those tensions, because we know in order to meet our housing goals, if we don't build, you know, extra density in a specific area, then we know we're going to have to redistribute those housing units, those planned housing units elsewhere throughout the city. So how can we better plan for that? And where we can't redistribute those densities, how do we better create design standards that are required in new buildings so that people aren't exposed to undue risk for their property or for themselves? One example of that is for flooding. Historically, most, you know, high-rise buildings, larger buildings, they have their electrical units concentrated in the basements. And if we plan for, you know, a tower that is going to be in an area that floods, for example, the Still Creek area, right near Gilmore SkyTrain Station, we know that those basements are likely going to flood. So we need to be creating requirements for that electrical equipment to be moved to the second floor or the third floor, and to look at ways that we can protect people, especially people whose you know, safety and like livelihood relies on the operation of electrical equipment.
Once again, that was CJSF in conversation with Burnaby City Councilor Allison Gu on the recent motion that was passed to direct city staff to plan for and mitigate the risk of extreme weather events in Burnaby. Thank you so much for listening to this piece. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby. This piece would not be possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also listen to this piece on frequencynews.ca.
Something curious, something cultural, something unserious, sometimes serious, something mundane, something every day, though not even really that. Tune into Typically Tuesdays, airing every Monday. You heard that right, Monday. From 3 to 4 p.m., your hour of quasi-cerebral talk and tunes.
Coming up this afternoon at 3 o'clock, Peter.
Yes, so I'm going to talk about the history of the United States trade with mainland China, starting in 1979. Now, what kind of precipitated this was Nixon's, he did diplomatic relations in 1972 with Henry Kissinger. Which was sort of, they were trying to do, you know, because they were trying to, I guess, have the Marxist regime of China help deal with the Soviet Union. I guess that was sort of the...
And prior to that, there hadn't been any formal diplomatic relations between the communist regime on the mainland and the United States since, even though the communists had taken over mainland China in 1950.
You brought up a very important point. I forgot about that. Was when they reversed it, instead of having Taiwan being a member of the UN and mainland China not being it, it was turned the other way around because of that trip.
Right. Basically a recognition of reality that, there are still two Chinas, China and Taiwan, but the communist regime on the mainland represented the vast, essentially the bulk of China.
Well, part of the issues that come when you get such an more of an alignment is that human rights in mainland China and so on. I mean, it was sort of their choice in 1972 to reverse it. I mean, but the Taiwan country really didn't do anything wrong.
Yeah.
It seems kind of unfair in that way. What kind of precipitated was this ping pong tournament in 1971, actually? So that, but Chairman Mao died in 1976. And so there was really no trade relations until 1979. And actually, on the Council on Foreign Relations, which I'm a bit critical of the organization, they actually were for the second Iraqi war, just to point out. But they do have an interesting timeline for me to go through. The 1979 was the beginning, but it's funny that they are in their timeline. They say mainly that there was Taiwan relations and so on. So it was sort of like an incidental thing, actually, that it just incidentally started under Jimmy Carter. Now, this is a really odd one. For 1982, they say, Ron Reagan visits China in April 1984, and in June, the U.S. government permits Beijing to make purchases of U.S. military equipment. Now that's a bit of an odd, bit odd. For Tiananmen Square. In response, the U.S. government suspends military sales to Beijing and freezes relations. Now, under Clinton, of course, resumes trade. In fact, we really don't get a trade imbalance to like the mid-1990s, 1995. What was the concern previously? What was the Japanese?
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of surprisingly enough, the Jap during the 1980s, that was the real fear. In fact, it was trade with mainland China was kind of white noise in many ways.
There's a real sort of all the angst was about how well the Japanese were doing in terms of trading. Yeah, you know, I guess in general, but also in terms of particularly trading to the United States and the way that the Japanese, for instance, in the car industry had gone from very small in the 60s to nearly dominant in the, not dominant, but a huge chunk of market in the by the 1980s.
Well, okay, I'm going to get on my tablet. During the 80s or... There was a very huge tariff placed on Japanese cars, actually, mm-hmm. and I'll get that specific thing later. But I want to have my tablet on this because in the year 2000, President Clinton signed the U.S.-China Relations Act of 2000 in October, granting Beijing permanent normal trade relations with the United States and paving the way for China to join the World Trade Organization in 2001. Between 1980 and 2004, U.S. trade rises from $5 billion to $231 billion. In 2006, China surpasses Mexico as the United States' second biggest trading partner after Canada. So that's sort of the beginning of it. One mm-hmm. thing that was sort of Bill Myers, he's sort of with a PBS guy, right. the guy that interviewed Joseph Campbell and all this.
Yeah.
I saw something quite a while ago, maybe like 20 years ago, that they were talking about like how to have a resurgence, economic resurgence in the United States. They're saying like part of the problem was that in the 1930s, if you just give the average citizen money, that they'll automatically, all that goes to American goods. It sort of stimulates that. And they, mm-hmm. now, how true that was, I don't know. I mean, they were saying, well, then if you do for consumers, you give consumers money or, you know, government money or whatever it means, then it doesn't automatically mean that it's going to go to American manufacturing jobs, which right, was the argument.
You know, a certain amount of any consumer goods are now manufactured overseas and then imported.
Well, what I'm finding is actually, and I think last week Stephen Fan was bringing up a few points that mainland China now is farming off a lot of the like you go to Walmart, you get it from Bangladesh a T-shirt,
mm-hmm.
And so his argument last week. Well, I mean, he was presenting a few facts that they're stepping up on their high tech, I guess. Mm-hmm. They said for medical things. So that's been I got here someone of the Japanese things. Oops. Anyway, oh, I get it. Okay, so, but. Oh, like I think there was one point in the 1980s, every VCR was made in Japan. I don't think had you heard that previously, Magnus? That the technology?
Yeah, well, I know that you know at one time, for example, there was a robust in American industry in like televisions, for example. Televisions were manufactured in the United States. Whereas nowadays, I don't think any televisions are made in the United States. And there's other products like that, too. I think maybe like freezers and things like that and some other, and maybe refrigerators. But, you know, there are certain whole product classes that aren't even made in the United States. TVs are definitely one of them. And a bunch of others. You know, so when we get this talk of tariffs and stuff, you know, tariffs only work if you have some local production that can fill that gap. But when it comes to things like televisions or, you know, kitchen appliances and things like that, all those tariffs are going to do is raise prices for American consumers.
Oh, here's the exact yep. number I got. Restraints on Japanese autos were equivalent to a tariff rate of exceeding 60%. So that was during the 1980s.
Right.
So it makes me wonder why anybody got a Japanese car in the United States during that time.
Well, I guess part of the issue is that they were much more efficient in their manufacturing. So maybe they were cheaper and better value for a time. I think the big American automakers have closed that gap. But now they're facing a similar challenge from Chinese automakers. And I believe here in Canada we have a huge, and the United States and some other Western countries, we have a huge tariff on Chinese electric vehicles because they're so cheap.
Well, did you know that during that period, did Canada have the same tariffs on Japanese cars as the United States? Maybe we had more Japanese cars during that era.
That I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised just because that might have, you know, you know, I mean, between AutoPac prior to NAFTA and then NAFTA and then the more recent agreement, you know, there's a lot of stuff that goes into making an integrated automobile industry where automobile parts and cars and everything just moves across the border freely without any real restraint so that the...
Until this idiot.
Yeah, until these
because
new threats.
Because it's just... It's going to be stupidity because it's like how a car is produced between the United States and Canada at this time. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Hopefully there'll be no, he won't have the legality to do it, but What I read was something, it was only four pages. It was a research on the trade imbalance between China and the United States. Now, this was from the Department of School, it was from the North China University of Technology in Beijing, China. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that they bring up is that they would like their currency to be more accepted worldwide. It seemed like they were contending in this paper, which is coming from their point of view, that they have a low currency, and that is basically the reason why there is a trade imbalance. And they were sort of – I think that there's actually one thing about what the colloquial term, the petrodollar, mm-hmm. what it really is, and this is what it specifically is. Every OPEC country can only accept American currency for its petroleum. It cannot accept gold. It cannot accept other currency. It cannot accept sheep or cattle. Yeah. That is the only thing it can accept, which, of course, backs up the American dollar. Yeah. And that's not the only commodity, supposedly, that there are agreements about worldwide. Oh, the other thing, I wanted to bring this up last week. When you heard about the Washington – you don't hear about the Washington consensus.
Mm-hmm. But
what it specifically is the idea that the Federal Reserve – and the offices of the World Bank, the United Nations World Bank, the United Nations International Monetary Fund in Washington, D.C., are basically backing up the American dollar because the Federal Reserve is basically it's not quite a conspiracy. I mean, there's a lot to say a backup. And actually, it's not – when it was presented in the 90s, or that was more was the Battle of Seattle, and later they even had a demonstration against the World Bank and the IMF in 2000. That concept was that people say it's not part of the United Nations, but it's part of the actual system, the United Nations system, the World Bank, the IMF.
Yeah.
That basically the Federal Reserve was in conjunction with it, and it was protection of the American dollar. Now, this paper, which it was sort of saying that their argument was that this would solve more problems if the currency of mainland China was more used, and they were saying that would perhaps help out with the trade imbalance and help both sides.
I know that it's not an issue I've heard for a few years, but there used to be a lot of complaints about that the Chinese were sort of artificially keeping their currency low, which reduced the prices of their products relative to the American dollar. I haven't really heard that complaint for a few years, but that's sort of...
Well, I just got it kind of randomly, but it is from...
Yeah.
It's in the English language.
Yep.
But they, what was interesting, I guess it's a pretty low level report, but it's saying that they feel that they, and from their point of view, or the author's point of view, they would have liked the more prominence of the, because you really can't use it. I mean, they use it themselves, but they want to,
it abroad.
From an international.
We don't have time to talk about it today, but it'd be an interesting thing to look into. Maybe we'll talk about this in a future program, just what benefits that gives the United States and would give China to be, you know, to be that international currency, right? That currency everyone's trading in. Because I've heard how it does, in fact, sort of confer significant benefits on the United States in terms of their freedom of movement. But unfortunately, we only have a minute left in the show, so we don't have time to dig into that. But it's sort of an interesting thing in perspective of that, because if China became a much more prominent currency of international trade...
Well, it's also the human rights aspect about that. But I did read that paper, and that was their perspective of the paper on that.
All right. Well, thanks for that today, Peter. China, trade with China, you know, which has gone from, and, you know, with the United States, but in the West, from nearly, from very small numbers around 1980 to, of course, today, where China is one of the dominant trading nations in the international community. Coming up soon, coming up in about 15 seconds, is Democracy Now! Stay tuned for Wandering Rhythms at noon and Typically Tuesday up at 3 o'clock. Thanks, Peter.
Okay.
We'll see you all next week. Yes. Stay tuned for Democracy Now!